Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and I'm sitting in a very, very wet Inverness at the moment. The fact that we've got no snow around is entirely my fault because I'm currently constructing a polar sledge, a pulk at the moment, which is a purchase of which has put pay to any possibility of the white stuff at all. I'm very pleased to introduce my guest today. He's known simply as Heavy, but I'll tell you a little bit about his background. I think he's probably one of the most experienced and the biggest authorities on mountain rescue in Scotland. There is, basically. He was a member of the RAF Mountain Rescue for 37 years and was team leader of RAF Lucas and deputy leader of the RAF Valley in North Wales. And he was the senior team leader at the Lockerbie disaster and has worked for the Scottish Mountain Rescue Committee for over 20 years. There's a lot more. that's only a little bit of what he's done, but I think I'll let him tell you about the rest. Hi, Heavy. How are you?
Not bad at all, John. The only thing you missed, I was the team leader up at Kinloss, which is the area covering the north of Scotland, which is the... It was the premier place to be, you know,
where
all the great mountains are. So there we go.
I would imagine it was. Yeah. I always, my primitive knowledge or my basic knowledge of mountain rescue teams, although I was in the Cairngorm team myself for quite a while, but I'm always stirred by when you go into Corrie McFerrica in on Ben A. And you read the story of a Lancaster that crashed into those cliffs?
Yeah, it was a Lancaster from Kinloss, John. And people wonder why there was a RAF mountain rescue team in it. It was formed during the war, actually, to assist people in the mountains because there's so much flying. And if you're a mountaineer and you love Scotland, there's aircraft crashes everywhere. Sadly, they lost more aircraft training than they did in the war, in the Second World War. So the one is well worth a visit in that magnificent cathedral called Corrie McFerrica. And it's a Lancaster crash there. And the actual gully that the propeller is stuck in is called Fuselage Gully, which is quite incredible, you know. Such a place.
Yes, it is. I believe, if I'm right in thinking, well, you're sure you'll know better than I, but they got blown off course, is that right? And they thought they thought they were over flat land, whereas in fact they were right smack in the middle of Torridon, which if you're flying at 3,000 feet is not the place to be, I guess, you know.
Yeah, and it was very primitive navigation, and they were flying, you know, young pilots, you know, very, very young, training in terrible weather, technical kit, what they've got nowadays, GPSs. They were navigating for navigating sake and relying on met recordings. And I've read a lot of that. I must have visited that site 50, 60 times. And I take relatives up to these places, John, because whatever you think of the military and all the rest of it, and God forbid wars and things. And I was very lucky. I was on a great side of the military, the search and rescue bit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But all these young people were national servicemen, you know. They had no option. They had to go in and they flew. And sadly, a lot of them crashed and died.
Yes. So how did your own interest in the hills and how did you get into the RAF and how did all that start for you?
Well, I was very lucky because my father was a minister in Ayr and I was the last of five and I was like the wild child. But one of the ways I loved and the thing I really did love was going in the mountains, and we went to Arran. You know, I can remember being in the Arran Hills at 5 year old, the whole five of us and my mum, so seven of us in total doing, you know, we did the Aki Origin stuff, you know.
Oh, I
fell, and we did some great stuff. And then going down to Galloway and joining the Boys Brigade and doing the Bothies in Galloway, because, you know, that's a huge, very famous area.
Yeah.
And I get into the mountains. The mountains was my kind of saviour, because you'll probably know, especially with your background, I was quite a wild child. Ministers' sons are either very good or very bad, and I was quite wild.
I see.
And And I think I was given the option, join the military, because there was no work in the early 70s, very early 70s. So I joined the RAF, God knows why. And I became a catering accountant, God knows why. I haven't a clue. But my main aim was to get into mountain rescue, which I did in 1972.
Right. And well, what are your sort of earliest recollections of the rescues that you did then, but way back then?
Well, I mean, first of all, I got refused to join the team because I was 7 stone, 5'4". I was tiny, hence the name.
Seven? Oh, I see. Is that? I did wonder how you got your nickname. I see. Yeah,
so I was told to go away, and then they found out I was a caterer. So that's very handy because we were out every weekend, 3 weekends a month, training all over Scotland. Because I did the food, I was accepted and I came out. And in the first year, you know, I did, we were averaging about 20 call-outs a year, 10 fatalities in these, you know, all through the years. And my first big incident was 3 climbers who fell in Tower Ridge, Navy climbers, killed, sadly. And I was a young lad, was taken by quite a famous mountaineer, John Hind, who was one of the team leaders. Uh-huh. And we climbed Tower Ridge to go and see what had happened. That was my earliest recollection of mountaineering and tragedy. And it's, you know, but also we did lots of rescues, saving people. 95% of our incidents, John, weren't aircraft. They were mountaineering accidents.
And right.
Whereas Cairngorm covers the Cairngorm area, we had to cover the whole of the north of Scotland.
Right.
So we were going to different base camp every weekend. Skye, Torridon, Braemar. So it was wonderful for me because Monday to Friday was a job with most people. And at the weekend, I was free, ticking Moomin Roads and starting to learn to climb. So it was a great time.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. And my memories of that sort of era, I think we're probably not far off the same age. I don't know. But certainly my memories of that era was that a lot of the mountain rescue situations, certainly sort of, I suppose, in Derbyshire, in the lakes, I suppose, perhaps more so, but we're down to the very, very basic nature of equipment and the fact that the vast majority of people didn't really have any specialist equipment at all.
No, I mean, people were still, I mean, our equipment wasn't great, John, I'll be honest with you. You know, we were using XWD, you know, War Department stuff, and it took a while for us to get decent gear, so we ended up buying our own stuff. But most people were just, you know, it was a different mountain. The mountains were different then. There was very few paths, and Munros were just getting popular.
Yeah.
People made a lot of their own kit. But a lot of the accidents, no matter how far you go through and the problems people have are navigation, you know, and they still have the same kind of problems, navigation slips, trips. But 99% of people go out and have a wonderful day in the hill.
Yeah.
And I've never ever wanted to be that. I'm not a mountain rescuer. I call myself a mountaineer. Not a great climber, but I love them. I love climbing. Uh-huh. I love the mountains. And I was so lucky to be doing that job. And when you get somebody who's in an accident and you can bring them off, you won't get a better feeling than that.
That's right. I mean, just going back for a moment to the primitive equipment. I mean, when I started in those days, you might be interested to learn that I was the proud possessor of a pair of RAF trousers, which were wool. By far, I have to say, the smartest pair of trousers I actually possessed at the time. And it was always comforting to me. They'd been my uncle's in the Second World War. And it was sort of always comforting to me to know that my trousers played a role in the downfall of Hitler. you sound
like Spike Milligan there.
Yes, that's right. Well,
there could be another book in that, John.
There could well be. I'm noticing, I don't know whether you obviously, I'm sure you're very familiar with the trends in mountain rescue at the moment, but it seems to me in some ways that we're actually going back a little bit at the moment, because I'm hearing, particularly in the lakes and places like that, of a lot of folk being caught out with really, really novice mistakes, like not having a torch and it goes dark, or, you know, going up not in the right kind of gear. And I don't know if I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are on this, but I remember when I was getting into the hills, everywhere you went, there were posters, be prepared. You should have this, you should be able to navigate, you should have decent clothes or whatever, most of which we couldn't afford. But do you think we're... Is there any truth in what I've said, do you think?
Well, I'm not into signs, John, anyway, on the hills, you know, from other things, and very few people read them. But there is a kind of Twitter and Instagram culture where people say that's a hill, and they're all taking a good. Very few people take, you know, photos in bad weather, so they see it as great. You know, they do. You know, that is a fact.
That's true. Very much so.
Go out, and a lot of people are using the mountains as a gymnasium nowadays.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, the mountains can bite very quickly. John, I'm not a mountain. I'm not this guy that says don't do this. When I was running and doing stuff, I had some great days with my dog, me doing huge Monroe days on her own, completely contrary to what you should, you know. But it's okay. It's all you judge the risk and you do it. But people, I think nowadays a lot of people with equipment, they don't have a clue what they're doing with it though.
Yes, I mean, accessible and decent equipment these days. I mean, you know, I virtually have to get a mortgage out to buy my first decent sleeping bag. but you can pick up gear very easily. I think a lot of the time these days, people are perhaps, you know, they perhaps got a little bit more money than we had, and gear is relatively cheaper. But obviously, time pressures on folk though are different these days. So I think people are sort of got more cash, but they haven't got a lot more time.
No, and time criticalness means I've come to Scotland, I've got to Winterquayne. I've just been over on the west visiting a friend, and you know there's no snow in the hills. Coming back, it was a blizzard. Benny and Leah looked absolutely magnificent, covered in snow. You know, but people come up. I'm going to go up, and no matter what the weather is, they're going because it's. You get forced into this, especially, you know, if you're living a busy life. Yes. I'm retired now, so I can pick my days, John.
I've done
50 years of getting battered by the weather, and my body's in bits. You know, I'm nearly 70 now, but I go out and have my days and still enjoy it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I think a lot of people, you really need to look at what you're up to. And they don't understand everything's there now. The weather forecasts are pretty good. You know,
they can tell you every hour
what's going on. If, you know, you know, right. And it's, remember, a forecast is not an exact.
No.
That's what I say. It's a guide. You know, and you've got your avalanche stuff now. You've got all this information. And I spend a lot of time giving lectures, but you're giving lectures to people who know a lot. It's trying to get the other people to just go out. And it's, how do you get to them? It's very hard to educate. And you can only educate by maybe putting a nice photo up of a mountain and putting, I do a wee blog and I always usually give a top tip about it, you know?
That's a great idea. I'll put a link to your blog there.
I did a wee tweet coming across four seasons in one day, and yet it was a hailstorm, and all that hail that was lying in the road and sweeping across the road, that forms a really bad layer on the fresh snow that's coming, which would cause an avalanche. So you're trying to pass stuff on, but the best thing to do is to go out with somebody with a bit of experience, or even better, pay for something. You pay £300 for a blinking jacket, some people. They won't pay 50 quid to go out in the day and learn some good skills of good people. You know?
Yeah. I think things have radically changed since I started. I mean, you know, fundamentally, most of them, there actually weren't many courses about. And obviously, I think one of the things that's happened, partly perhaps because of the internet, when I got into climbing, the only real way to do it was to join a club, if the guys could deign to take you out as a complete novice, they'd show you how to tie the knots and they'd give you some ideas. And you know, I got given a load of old kit, stuff that nobody was using anymore, but it got me going. I think we've moved away from that now, though, because, you know, if I wanted to find out, suppose about a particular bothy or a particular route, I go to the internet.
But yeah,
that's not the same, I think, as getting direct information from people who've done it and been there, because there's no substitute for that. You think?
No, I agree. I mean, I'm in the Mountaineering Club, the Murray Mountaineering Club, which is a local club, and we used to run a winter skills day every year, you know, to give the new people. And we're doing a weekend this weekend, probably the worst weather But that's great. And there was a bit of an attitude, oh, it's not our job to train people. But when you say to somebody experienced, how did you learn? Somebody took you under the wing. Nobody, you know. And I love giving it back because, I mean, that was a great job of being a team leader when you were training people. 90% of the kids ended up better than me.
Which is not
an ego thing, but it's a great thing to see people coming on and becoming and enjoying it, and hopefully they're going to pass their skills on.
But I mean,
there is some good stuff on the internet. Like Mountaineer Scotland do a great amount, and their website is full of good stuff. The thing you've got to be aware of in the internet, as in life, the internet can be full of loads of rubbish as well.
Yes, that's right.
You know, it's got a danger in it, you know. So, and it's trying to, I very rarely climb, or, you know, when I was climbing a lot, I've only climbed with a couple of people I didn't know and it didn't go well.
I think we've all had that experience.
So I'm very careful who I go with, you know, and I've got good mates now and all the rest of it. So, that's all about learning and joining. You go out in the hills and you'll
It is. I mean, I always feel that. Well, one of the problems with the press is if an accident happens, it has to be somebody's fault. Yeah. And they have to find out this person was an idiot or these people were really stupid. Now, when I was involved in the rescue team, I never rescued an idiot. I rescued people who perhaps didn't have the experience. And, you know, hand on heart, you know, when I was learning, I did all sorts of daft things that should have got me into trouble. And sometimes you're lucky. And you get away with it, and sometimes you're not, and so you can't go into a shop and buy you can buy a jacket, you can buy an ice axe, but you can't buy experience, and it's kind of those mistakes. It's the mistakes that make that teach you more than what you get right. Do you think so? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. What a thing I tried to start in the flying world. If they have a mistake, if you make a mistake flying, they used to say, you know, they had a kind of page with the in their flight safety stuff where if you made a mistake as a pilot or a navigator or as a winchman, there would be no blame coming to you because you're passing your mistake on to somebody else, so they won't make it. And it's like an honesty box, you know. And there's a lot more of it in mountaineering now. I've always been a good, hopefully, because I've made so many mistakes. But it's a way you learn things. The other thing you get when you get to my age, I mean, I only climb a couple of times a year. I have to be very careful, even putting my harness on and remembering the stuff, because you have a thing called skill fade.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it happens to the best, you know, so we always check each other. So easy to make a mistake.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
Because we're only humans. Nobody's perfect. And when you see how people get bad accidents, sometimes it's just simple mistakes people make, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, my sort of theory about accidents is that if it's for a serious accident to occur, normally it's not just one thing. It's often a combination of things. Like you might slip somewhere and it turns out that your crampons aren't attached properly or whatever. And these things add up. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I was the accident statistician and I did a lot.
Oh, right.
I did it a lot for years, and I recorded all Kinloss's incidents from 1944. It's quite amazing, because seeing a big search, and I did a lot of searches in the Cairngorms with Peter Quiff
and Peter was
a great friend. Peter was the chairman, I was the vice chair, and we got on really well. And I remember doing one search, and he said, "Oh, why are you going to?" And I would say, "I'm not putting my guys in unless I agree where they're going to go, you know, because they're my people." I'm not a sheep, and I don't, you know, this is where my guys are best. Anyway, you know, we found this person because that's where they ended up before, you know. Mm-hmm. So the history of people repeating the same mistakes is, I mean, you look at Loch Arbour, you can tie a lot of their incidents to where they are, you know. It used to be Five Finger Gully, now it's Curry Hygiene at the back, and, you know, Carmogenic Arete, people following. So there's a huge repercussion. But when you get to the remoter areas like Ben Claybrick and Ascent, and there's not that many incidents, and all these incidents can be lost within 15, 20 years, John. So once you start a big search for somebody and they don't turn up, people's memories are short. So you really need to look back and say, what happened before?
Oh, I never thought of that. And that's an interesting
point. I did a lot of work in that, and I still do. I'm not involved with teams anymore, but I've always been very, very interested in where people ended up.
Or what happened to them.
And I do a lot of work with relatives as well still, because my wee blog, you know, people come back to me because I write about incidents. And people don't, you know, especially nowadays, people want a lot more knowledge. And sometimes it takes 30 years for a child to say, what happened to my dad? Can you help me? And you'll never know exactly what happened, but you can put stuff together, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said there about Five Finger Gully, because that's a gully. That's not on the north face of the bend. It's over Glen Nevis, isn't it?
By the tourist route. But it's not so bad now because they've got poles up and stuff on their things of people not veering in there. But you'll see there's a lot more going into the back near the water slide.
Oh, right. Has that changed? I didn't know that.
I mean, that's only just me looking. I don't know because I'm not that much, but I can see. We only did a few incidents there, but there's quite a few every now and again.
It used to be, Five Finger Gully used to be a sort of trap, didn't it?
I was in there. Oh, awful place.
Yeah. Well, if you didn't follow the Red Burn down from the hill, you sort of veered off slightly. It didn't take much of a mistake to end up in there, did it really?
And there's some very good mountaineers ended up in there.
Is that right?
Yeah. But you come off the bend, you think it's over. It's not over till you're sitting, drinking your first pint or your first cup of coffee.
Aye. That's right.
Sweet, and you're tired and you make a mistake. And again, you got a lot of people who think they're, you know, I don't need to navigate. You've got to really keep navigating.
Yes, I think that's true. My feeling certainly is, and this is one of my little sayings in a way, I think that if people are in a group, say four or five, every single person should be navigating.
Yeah.
What they tend to do is they tend to leave it to Steve. He's pretty good with the map and compass. He'll navigate there. But if he makes a mistake, there's no one there to check him. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean I hammered the people in the club with self-reliance, you know, and to be self-reliant, that leader who's taking you off the hill could be the guy who's dragged you up to a ridge. He's tired. I've been there. I've been that tired.
Yeah.
So it's easy for you to, and you just follow on because it's the thing to be. But I need people to check what I'm doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've walked off Ben Nevis the wrong way, you know.
Yeah, it's easy, but I've walked off quite a few hills.
It's a miracle we're here, really, you know. I think the smartphone has changed things a lot as well, because, and I don't know whether this is true. I have a lot of pet theories, you know. I think we've a kind of culture, particularly if you're not on the mountains a lot, if you're new to hill walking, that basically a smartphone can pretty well do anything for you. You know, you can order a pizza, it can tell you where you are, it can do pretty well anything. But once you get on the hill, you realize actually a smartphone's pretty limited. Is that something you
do? I mean, I use them all the time. There's great apps, OS Maps, wonderful, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it keeps me right. But people forget your smartphone is designed for a temperature in a house of 20 or whatever it is, 20 degrees.
Yeah, absolutely.
You take it out into minus 10, the battery will not last. So you always have to carry batteries and be careful what you're using.
Yeah.
You know, and touch screens, when it's snowing, you can't use your gloves. You know what I mean? So they've got the limitations. So you've got to, they're a great bit of kit, but always have the backup there.
Absolutely. I mean,
the other thing is there's still areas, John, where you don't get anybody.
That's right. Absolutely. There's a lot of areas like that. Yeah. I just say there's a lot of areas. And I think people don't realize that. I think if you live in the south of England, then I guess pretty much everywhere is covered. But up here, that's far from the case, you know.
And I also think people do think if they get into trouble, I can immediately call for a helicopter. This chopper will come winging out the sky.
Aye.
But it doesn't, I mean, my last job was 4 years working in a rescue centre where we were deploying helicopters all over the UK. And there's only that many helicopters in Scotland, you know, and in England. So if they're taking a baby to hospital, they could be out of the game. Yeah, you know, and you're relying on your team and, you know, from Cairngorm, sometimes 2-3 hours to get your incident. You know,
oh, God, yeah.
Back of the can. People are going to hang about, and they don't understand that. It's not instant recovery. It isn't a good day.
no, no, so that's right, that's right.
Self-reliance is a huge thing, and we've got to keep preaching that as a group, as a person, whatever.
That's right, that's right. Now, you did say before that you're in the process of writing a book. Now, where is that process right now, then?
Well, John, I have done thousands of words, and I've got my blog, but I had a kind of deal with Hodder and one of the big companies, but then I got ill for 3 or 4 years and I couldn't do it.
Oh, right.
But I produced a lot. And the other thing when I was doing it ended up quite dark, John, I'll be honest with you.
I can imagine. And, yes.
I've done a lot of dark stuff.
You know, well,
and I'm only human. And one of my things is I'm quite soft with it. People don't believe that, but I found it quite hard. But I've got a lot. I must have over 200,000 words.
Right. So you've got.
I've got a lot of stuff. All it needs is edited and put together. And my main thing was to get well and get fit, and then I'll get.
Absolutely.
I think the story I've got, John, is not about Cairn Gomer, but the Ben. It's all over Scotland and England. Mm-hmm. It's all over the islands doing other stuff. You know, because I've been rescued most of the islands, and the people you meet in the local areas, it's not about me, it's about the local teams and the local people. And, you know, it's another side of mountain rescue that people don't really know.
That's right, that's right. I mean, I think you touched upon something there, which, in writing my books, I found quite difficult, as you said at the outset, really, 99% of folk go on the hills and it's wonderful, they have a great time. But there is also, and I'm always very conscious that there is almost just one step away, the dark side of mountaineering.
And I did get involved in that, John. You know, one of the big things I would interview a lot of witnesses, even despite the local police doing it. And no disrespect to anybody or the team leader, the local team leader is usually so busy. He's got the guys out.
And then we come
in a few hours later, and I like to get talking to people to see what you could miss or what it isn't. And the thing with the police, and please, this is not in the guy, the police have been wonderful to me, but even the way they're dressed now with all the full combat gear on, you know, they're quite intimidating. Yeah. No, they are, and they don't, but I can get a lot more out of people because I think I'm a good talker. I can weather, and you get so much information from people. You build this bond up, and sadly, if it goes wrong, as it does now and again, then, you know, and I've searched for people for weeks, months, some people are never found, are they? No, but I was lucky in my time, we never didn't find.
I think that's always, yes. I mean, I often feel that the greatest sympathy really for the people who are left behind, the relatives and the families of people, because I think not knowing must be a terrible thing, you know?
Yeah, and it is. And I mean, at one point in the 90s, when the bad avalanches were on, I think there was about 8 or 9 people under avalanches we hadn't found yet. Mm. And we had to wait for the thaws.
People can't
believe that. And I've got slides of us 30 feet down digging in avalanche in snow in Scotland. People nowadays don't think that exists.
Oh, no, it used to, didn't it? That was one thing I really do mourn myself, the great cold winters we used to. The winter was always fickle, you know, it could always...
Yes, it was, yes.
It could always pop round the corner and then nip away again. Next thing you knew, you were sitting in the bunkhouse staring at pouring rain, you know? But I think it's a shame, because I think for mountaineers, winter was always the great season, and it was what you look forward to I think someone said, I can't remember who it was now, but in the summer, Scotland has hills, and in the winter, it has mountains. And I think that is so true. And I really think it's such a shame that season, I don't know, it may be gone forever now. It's hard to say.
But I mean, there's still great routes getting done in the Bend. 0.5 was done the other day, you know.
The ice is still there.
But again, because it becomes, there's not so much snow, then you've got other dangers with rockfall and all kinds of stuff. So
yes, yes.
It's becoming fickle, but it's still there. And we'll get a cold spell again. I'm quite sure we will, you know.
The winter's
the greatest time. And that's what I say to people. Get out on the hill.
Absolutely.
Even if you're going in the... When I was ill, John, I just walked into Angelic last Corey Thule and
oh yeah,
back and Jerry got a Liverpool Corey Grander when I wasn't well and just got into these Corries in winter. Nobody about.
No, massive, that's right. That's right. That's
frozen
right.
Frozen walks. You know.
I mean, yeah.
It's just I've spent my life running around the blinking hills and all over the world, but but the glens and the I mean, I was in the Bothy in December, Ben Alder Cottage. What a great trip we had in there, you know.
Yeah.
There's still so much to do, isn't there?
Oh no, the winters are. So you still reckon that I might get half off of me in me polar sledge?
Yeah, well, I think you might be just now. You'd be building an ark.
yeah. Well, I'm just hoping that when I get lost on my sledge, you'll be able to come and get me. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Oh, that won't be me. It'll be the young breed.
Oh, I'm sure you could tell them anyway. Listen, Abe, you'll have to come when you get your book out. You have to come on and talk about it. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
And you, John.
Thank you very much for coming along. And I'm sure both of us have got many years on the hills yet.
Okay. Yeah, and I look forward to bumping you, John.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Take care.
Take care. Thanks for talking to
me.
Bye-bye. Well, it was great to talk to David Heavy Wally there about his vast experiences in mountain rescue. As I say, it's pouring down here in Inverness rain, but I think it's snowing widely across the Highlands right now. And I'm sure everyone's dead keen to get out into the white stuff, but just remember, I'm guessing everywhere's going to be pretty avalanche prone for the next few days until it all settles down. By which time I'm guessing it'll thaw, but who knows? But anyway, I'm going to put links to Heavy's blog and also to Mountaineering Scotland. As he said, there's a lot of really good information on there if you want to learn more about mountain safety or you're thinking about getting out to the hills. But as I say, if you've enjoyed this little show, do subscribe to my podcast, because I'll be doing more of this. So anyway, now I'm hoping to get off in the snow myself in my little hot tent for the next few days. So I may be gone quite some time. Thanks very much for listening. I certainly hope I'll be talking to you again soon. Bye-bye then.